Welcome to Computer Science, E259. This is Lecture 3, DOM Level 3. My name is David Malin, and last time, recall, we covered a number of topics. We covered the basics of XML. We covered the basics of SACS, JAXP. We looked at Xerxes, talked a bit about parsing, and introduced Project 1. So before we dive into anything new today, I thought it might be useful to take a look back at what we did, in fact, do last time. This, recall, was the representative document that we started class off with. Let's pluck off a few pieces of jargon just to ease into tonight's material. Name one of the fundamental constructs that was manifest in this representative document. One of the concepts. One of the entities. Anything at all. So remember, we use this representative document to walk ourselves through a few fundamental building blocks of any XML document, some of which were requisite, some of which were optional. Give me any of those.
GTD, document.
Okay, so GTD, where do we see that? Well, it's line number two. And what was the role of this doc type element, as it's called? Okay, so it can include a schema that prescribes the manner in which the document is laid out, a DTD, and this is an alternative, as we'll see in a few weeks' time, to something like XML schema. And I misspoke a moment ago, doc type declaration, that's what it's typically called. What else is in this document that we slapped the name on? Okay, so we have comments, which are reminiscent of what you've used in HTML. So in line three up there, you have a comment. What was interesting about comments? With respect to the parsing of a document. Sort of comment trivia, if you will. Absolutely. The comments may ultimately get ignored so far as the parsing goes, which is to say that they're really meant for human eyes, and you are not necessarily guaranteed at your application level to actually receive those comments in, for instance, the document that is returned. This is in contrast with another section that might seem like comments, but really it's more of a special structure in here, which was what? C data, which is just character data, which was remarkable because it is parsed or unparsed? Unparsed. So PC data, recall, is pretty much anything like the word graduate or Jim Bob. That was PC data, we called it, and it's just text in the typical sense. And you have to be careful about not having two of the banned characters in PC data. What two characters cannot appear in PC data? Perfect. Ampersand and less than. Sort of a nuisance sometimes, but that's it so far as restrictions go. And we introduce a number of ways to work around that, which you're probably already familiar with in HTML. But the contrast then between something like a C data section and a comment section is that a C data section is entirely unparsed. The parser, when reading it, will recognize from these first few characters, this is a C data section. I'm just going to eat up all of the subsequent characters until I see the trailing delimiter, and at that point, I'm going to wrap it all up in one string and pass it to the receiving application or the SACS handler or whatever it is and leave it to that thing to deal with any of the markup inside of it. C data sections are worth bearing in mind, especially as you begin to do web-oriented XML type of markup where, for better or for worse, sometimes you have to escape stuff like JavaScript code that you might want to embed in an XML document, but you don't want to have to deal with rewriting special characters in it. You just want the raw data to be preserved in the document. Sometimes if you want to store raw HTML, as I've done here, it's sometimes easiest, if inelegant in some sense, to just wrap it up in a C data section so that it does not get parsed, but gets passed through raw. So I would say, generally speaking, use them sparingly because it's not often necessary to deploy them, but realize that if you're ever banging your head against the wall, trying to figure out why are all of my XML tags or HTML tags being stripped away? Well, odds are it's because they've been parsed and then only the raw content has been passed through, and not parsing them through C data sections can be one recourse. What else was in this representative document that was optional? Sort of skipped right over it. Okay, so the fourth real line of content, this question mark student DB, what was that thing called generally? processing instruction. And the processing instruction, we'll see one used in a real example next week when we introduce XSLT. But for now, think of that as an application layer comment. It's a piece of data that's not really meant for human eyes as much as it's meant for the receiving application, and it often controls the behavior of that application. For instance, what you'll see next week when we introduce XSLT is how Internet Explorer, Microsoft Internet Explorer, understands a certain processing instruction that's similar in structure to that one, but what that processing instruction is designed to do is to associate with an XML document an XSLT document. And what Internet Explorer is hard-coded to do is if it sees that certain PI at the top of an XML document referencing, in quotes, a certain XSLT document, it will, by definition, look for that local XSLT document, apply it to the XML document, and not show you the XML, but the resulting output of the processing. And we'll put that into more real terms next week, but that is one of the uses for it. Let's go all the way back up to the top. What's that thing at the very top of the document called? Yeah, so just an XML declaration. It is optional, which means you might see it, you might not see it. If it's there, what's its role? It shows the version of XML in use. And the encoding method for the text. So we won't spend much time on this because at least for American software developers, character encoding is often not so much an issue when you start dealing with internationalization and with documents that may not necessarily be in UTF-8 or in standard ASCII, but instead with more interesting character sets, this becomes more of a useful thing. But essentially what it says is what version of XML is in use throughout the document. The only two versions of relevance to us these days, 1.0 and 1.1, the marginal difference between, is pretty slim. But the fact that it can be present in a document is useful if, for instance, in the future we get up to XML 10.0, and for backward compatibility's sake, you want to be able to know how you should parse the document. It's in a little clue to the parser as to how to behave. And then the encoding type can often just be inferred from the first few bytes of a file, but adding it explicitly in the declaration there just tells the parser explicitly. For nine times out of, almost always in this course, you'll see something like UTF-8 or a standard ISO tag that you'll see in the document itself. In short, not so much an issue for most situations. All right, so now we've waved our hands at some of the metadata in the file, but not really the guts of this thing. What are some of the other concepts that we highlighted in the guts of this document between this thing and line 5? Okay, so we had elements, the first of which was called the root element. Any XML document must have one and only one. An empty document, even if it's called foo.xml, is an invalid XML document. It is a non-well-formed XML document, which means it won't parse. It will throw some error. So what you'll see at least once or twice in the semester, when we want to just whip up a quick and dirty example of something like XSLT or some other language, sometimes just to get around that requirement, we'll do something silly like include in a file called dummy.xml an empty element just called dummy so that the document is at least a well-formed XML document. But that's usually just for demonstration purposes. But that's why it's necessary, because it is in fact required. So inside of a root XML document, what child elements, you can have how many of those?
In this case, one student child element.
Okay, in this case, one, or really it looks like two, because we do have
two.
One down there. In general, how many children of the root element can you have?
There is no result.
Good. Zero or more? Excellent. Inside of an element can be what kinds of content? Okay, you can have attributes which have no inherent order, which is something we'll discuss more today when we talk about DOM, which means even if you write them left to right in alphabetical order, we said last week, just to bear in mind, you're not guaranteed to get them back out in that same order. You simply will get them out in some order. There were four different models of element content.
It can have another element.
Another element.
Or it can have PC data.
It can have PC data.
Or it can mix content.
Mixed content, which means? PC data and or elements together. And there was what fourth type of element content?
Empty element.
Empty element, which was one of these things. Or what else could you have in an empty element, but it'd still be considered empty? What else could I add to this without changing it from being an empty element, but it would still look more interesting? you could have attributes. Still an empty element. The empty element refers to the lack of children. Okay, something just to bear in mind, because as you start to look up things and references and so forth, you'll see this type of jargon, and if you forget what it means, it can cost you brain cycles just in trying to recall what they're actually talking about. So we have attributes, we've got values, quotes, silly little issue, right? Opened with double quotes, closed with double quotes. If you can nest single quotes inside, beyond that, you can't do many more layers of quotations. And I think we've pretty much plucked off most of the salient characteristics of an XML document. Any questions on the basics of an XML structure? Right. And we spend just this moment on them just so that we can build upon the basics, not because they're fundamentally that stimulating. But we did look at something that at least has a bit more of a theoretical spin, and something that's quite germane to Project 1 last week was this notion of grammars. Here might be a grammar in BNF form. What, based on your inference, does this grammar generate? What kinds of strings or what language? Nested parentheses, properly nested parentheses. So this again is a grammar where S presumably denotes the start state or the starting non-terminal. The first line suggests that if you have a non-terminal, a variable called S, it can be converted into, or it can generate, just the empty string, quote, unquote, or S can generate S followed by S, which sort of doubles now your capabilities, because each of those S's in turn can become two more S's, or the empty string, or a raw parenthesis followed by an S followed by a raw parenthesis. So the types of output that you might get would be this, would be valid output from that grammar, or rather this string would be consistent with that grammar. You could get something like that, which is just a set of parentheses nested inside another set. Could you get this? I hear no's here and some yeses here. I hear another no here, so we're pretty split. Someone who thinks yes, how could you generate this? Okay, can you repeat yourself? So we start with S and go to? True, we're almost there, but if we just use the last definition, how would we get another pair of open close parentheses to the right? Okay, so we can start with our start state. We can churn out from that one this transformation. What can we do from here? Well, now we can convert just one of these guys, for instance, to another pair, and now this can obviously go to rule 3, which means then you have this, 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 and then each of those in turn can just go to the empty string. So it is valid. So be careful, especially when applying this same sort of logic to the XML grammar, simplified as it is in Project 1, that you are in fact covering all of the cases. Because the types of cases we will test your own code on is anything that we can generate from the grammar. And as I caution, even though we give you some 8 different XML files in that sample directory, doesn't necessarily mean that we've provided you with all the possible variations of XML content. But consider this, if you can certainly just bang out some additional examples yourselves. You can try running your own parser on any XML document you find on the web. You might have to rip out some of the features you know your parser doesn't support, but there's an infinite number of test cases out there that you can play with as well. Something like this, we won't dwell on this one. This too is valid and could be generated from the grammar as well through just a recursive application of the same. Well, grammars don't have to be boring and arithmetic in foundation or language in nature, computer language in nature. We could have something like this, which is a simplified definition of an English sentence. So a sentence, if you think about it in a typical case, is usually a phrase followed by a verb followed by a phrase. And so using these same building blocks, could we generate, according to this grammar, some valid sentences? Again, just to reinforce the application of these grammars, this string here, can that be generated from this grammar with the start state being sentence? Well, we go to, from sentence, phrase, verb, phrase. Now, verb we can pluck off. A verb can be 8, so that's certainly fine. Now, let's deal with Jim. Well, Jim is a phrase. Well, phrase can become what? A noun, which can become Jim. And similarly, can a phrase become a noun, can become cheese. But so that you appreciate it briefly the fact that just because grammars might make sense and might seem structurally correct, you can also, especially when you start to build up larger grammars, start to get some pretty messy content, which is to say that just because a grammar looks correct and is simplified doesn't necessarily mean that it is, in fact, correct. When as expected, consistent with your expectations.
Okay, so it's correct. So I mean, so that's correct.
This is correct, but it might be nonsensical. So beware too when simplifying grammars, when implementing grammars, that you are in fact consistent with their definition. But this is just sort of a curiosity. You can get such random strings as these, but all of them are consistent with the grammar. And so if you're not quite comfortable with the so-called BNF form, I invite you to play around with these things and just understand how the grammars are working. The reason being, when you implement a parser, as we've done part of for you, and as you will complete, and in fact you will enhance it again with attributes and so forth, and perhaps white space support, it's incredibly straightforward to implement such a parser when you have grammars such as these. Because what does each of these rules, as you've seen in Project 1, easily lend itself to becoming in the world of, say, Java? Each of these rules can be implemented often as just a method unto itself. And that was our whole discussion last week of recursive descent parsing, like literally implementing the grammar with several methods. Read start tag, is start tag, read end tag, and so forth. Each of those was an implementation of each of the rules. John? That was just for aesthetic simplicity.
So to be correct, there wouldn't be any spaces.
Correct, and I think it would be fair for, yes, all of these, we should be collapsing the spaces if we wanted to be perfectly consistent.
Even though it's on the homework, so if you wanted to have spaces there, then you would have something like phrase, you could have phrase goes to noun, phrase goes to noun, or noun followed by a space, a tab, or a new line.
What I think I would have done to make this the simplest fix for this, and in fact we can do this for future terms, is just to do PowerPoint with its automatic formatting would be to do something like that. That would, with a, yeah. That's probably the simplest fix, because that's the starting point sentence.
Okay, but if you wanted it to be any white space, you would specify, for example, tab, new line.
Sure, absolutely. Indeed. So we would want to put it here, too. Yes, if we wanted to be more general, because currently this does not tolerate tabs or new lines or anything like that, if you wanted to, we could factor out these hard-coded spaces and actually say, you know what, this can just be an S. And then an S, in turn, could be a tab character or a white space or a new line character, whatever you wanted. Good question. So is there the notion of, say, regular expressions when it comes to the definition of these grammars? In fact, yes. And this is a useful thing to bear in mind as we proceed, because if you do, in fact, ever look at some of the official W3C recommendations, as we'll do briefly here, this is the XML 1.1 recommendation. Let me see if I can attribute type. See if we can find it. Control F is your friend in these things. So here's a simple example, the prologue, which essentially jumpstarts the entire document. Notice, even if you don't recognize all of these things, you notice the XML declaration. Well, in this definition, and let's see if I can make this a little bigger. In this definition, notice that you do have some, that's a different language, a different spec now. Well, here's one, better. This is even simpler. So in the XML recommendation itself, they define white space with a non-terminal variable called S, and what this essentially says in BNF form is that S denotes any of those sequences of characters, and those are simply the hex equivalents of what I presume is, which is the single white space, which is a tab, is X9, D is backslash R, I think. I'm probably confusing them, but it's that and plus a new line. And so you see things like the vertical bar, which typically in a regex it denotes OR. You see plus, which denotes one or more of those. You see parentheses, which are used for grouping. So yes, what we have here is a relatively simple grammar, but for more interesting constructs, you pretty much borrow from the language of regular expressions. Good questions. Other questions? No? Well, Sachs. Sachs in general was what?
Simple API for
XML. Okay, so that's true. You can use it for parsing XML documents. So it's an API. It's one of the it's one of the most popular APIs for processing XML documents. In fact, even for some of the higher level APIs like DOM, which we'll look at tonight, are often, if not almost always, built upon this lower level API of Sachs. In fact, one of the things you're doing in Project 2, or Project 1 rather, is in the latter part, which you probably haven't touched upon yet, is building a DOM out of a sequence of Sachs events. So these things are not necessarily mutually exclusive of one another. So it's an API for processing XML. You know, what kind of API is it? What's remarkable about it? Yeah. It's event-based. What does that mean? Good, good. And I'm going to put it in the passive voice. As the XML document is parsed, you can be informed of remarkable events like the start of an element, like the start of a character section, like the end of the document, the start of the document. In short, you essentially register with a Sachs parser what callback methods you want to be invoked when these things of remarkable interest are encountered. And the things of remarkable reinterest are essentially those things that we highlighted in our representative document, an element with some attributes perhaps and a name, a comment section, a CData section, a PI section, and so forth. Those can be all, you can be informed of such by way of your callback methods. And these callback methods were all sort of packaged up into one interface. In other words, if you wanted to use a Sachs parser, you had to call that parse method on an instantiated XML parser, but you had to pass it a reference to a what? A content handler. And the content handler is just a Java interface. We often, in our examples, have not been implementing the entirety of the content handler because it gets a little boring and mundane. Rather, we've been extending what class?
Default
handler, which is useful. It's a useful Java construct because it itself implements the entire interface, but with just open squiggly, close squiggly, which means it does nothing, which means you can very easily override that behavior polymorphically. So, good. So, some of the remarkable Sachs events look like these. There are several others, but the ones that we've highlighted or dwelled upon thus far have been these. And those are probably most, if not all, of the ones you'll make use of in, say, Project 1. If you're curious now, what are the other Sachs events that might be triggered during the parsing of a document? How do you answer that question for yourself? And the listserv is not the answer. And mail init post is not the answer. What do you do? Okay, a good book is always a good answer. But if I could not emphasize enough last week, there was one resource that in this world of XML and JAXP in general, all of your answers are in there. When it comes to how to program some of this stuff. Right, it's just the Java doc. Right, sort of such a simple thing, but again, one of the most useful links you and prior semesters of students will likely make use of or feel inclined to make use of is, again, under our resources section, the top set of links are these APIs, the second one of which is the latest JAXP specification. So I'm curious as to what else is in a content handler. Well, let's click on over. We know that we already know about characters. We know about end document, end element. There's this thing about prefix mapping. There's some issue with white space, which may or may not prove germane to Project 1. Processing instructions can be handled. Entities, just some other stuff. And again, all the answers are either in the recommendations themselves for the more esoteric XML questions, but for anything Java related, this API is usually your friend. And bear in mind that with Java 1.4.2, JAXP was integrated, incorporated into the Java specification itself. So Sun Microsystems said, essentially, wow, XML processing with Java is becoming so popular, let's actually integrate it into the official JDK 1.4.2. So you will actually see many of these same classes and interfaces in the Java 1.4.2 code itself. However, as I think I mentioned last week, or will now mention, the JDK 1.4.2, and I think even 1.5, ships with an older version of Xerxes and this thing called Xalin. And so in this world of XML processing, frankly, it is typically quite good practice to update these plugin modules yourself. So you recall a gentleman last week asked about why we use this factory approach, instantiating a factory and then churning out an XML parser. Well, one of the reasons for that is so that we can be independent of hard-coded names for implementations of these XML parsers and objects and so forth, and so that you can override them, upgrade them without overhauling your entire JDK installation. And those of you who have walked yourselves through the process of Project 1, setting up your own machine, be it macOS, Windows, Linux, what was one of the things you were instructed to do in the footnotes when setting up Java 1.4.2 on your own machine? Right. You need to create, in accordance with Sun's endorsed standards override mechanism, a directory called endorsed in a certain place in your Java installation, and in there you can drop a whole bunch of jars. And according to the JDK spec, it will look in that directory for classes and jar files and interfaces that might very well override the default implementations. And as programmers, bear in mind that usually the solution to this would just be to add some new jar to your class path. Doesn't work, because the stuff that ships inherently with the JDK has a higher priority when it comes to iterating over all of the installation packages. So that's why you override it in this way. And there's one other way, I believe, to do it by way of system properties, but just dragging a new jar into that folder is probably the easiest. So in short, when emerging from this class in a few months' time, if you ever make use of Java, whether it's 1.4.2 or 1.5, realize that at least in 1.4.2, and I don't recall offhand what spec 1.5 supports, 1.4.2 implements the JAXP 1.2 interface, which is, for our purposes, older than 1.3, which is what we've been preaching, and does not have as many functions, does not have as many methods as JAXP 1.3 does. Which is to say, just beware writing code on one platform and then expecting it will work on older versions. Okay. Sort of common sense, but might be easily forgotten if one is taught that it ships with Java. All right. So that was last time. This time we have a fun new API for XML, which will also lead us into the next two lectures, which focus on XSLT and XPath, which will be much more higher level and will actually allow you to think hierarchically and structurally about XML documents and diving down in and grabbing arbitrary data. You'll find DOM as well as XSLT to be, I think, easier APIs than SAX, because SAX requires generally that you write more code in order to achieve what you might think are relatively simple tasks. So you can do more with these APIs, and we'll spend a bit more time on my first XML parser at the conclusion. What we'll do for section tonight, which will be in room 106, just like last time, it'll be, I think, an even more casual chit-chat about the project, where I'll do a bit more code walkthrough with regard to the DOM-specific code. But those of you who stuck around last week recall that we pretty much did a walkthrough of most of the code base, if verbally, and relatively few questions require this background on DOM, so I think we'll do it more as Q&A tonight if you'd like to stick around with questions or concerns or troubles you're having with Project 1. But before that, are there any questions, comments, or troubles with Project 1, conceptual or otherwise, now? How many of you out of curiosity have opted to develop on your own machines as opposed to NICE? Okay, so most of you. So this is to say, if you're struggling with some silly configuration issue, certainly email me as you've been doing, but also feel free to make use of the listserv, since others are probably struggling with similar issues as well, especially installation-oriented. So the first question on the table, and the answer, of course, is in front of you if you have the handout, so try to focus more up here, is DOM level 3. Level 3 is like version 3. There's level 1, there's level 2. Each level adds some more features. At the end of the day, they all have the basic building blocks, at least that we'll focus on and most people would focus on. Why? Well, why would we introduce a new API? Probably because there were some shortcomings with a prior API. At least that's sort of how you would think the course would lead itself. So what was bad about SACS? And I'm speaking in the past tense, but for some, perhaps this is still to be future tense. What will be bad about SACS when you tackle Project 1 this week? I can't edit it. And why? In what sense do you mean? Okay, so you can't really... Well, you could edit an XML document with a SACS handler if, for instance, you wanted to make changes to the attributes. For instance, every time start element is called, you're passed a list of the attributes and you're passed the element's name. So you could just spit out with a printf or with a print line method the same element name, and you could just change the values around in the attributes. So you couldn't change documents if implemented correctly. I'll partially answer. It's easier to do it with different APIs than with SACS. Other comments? Mm-hmm. So, arguably, you could figure out everything you wanted with a SACS event handler, right? If I say, here's the start of a student's element, what do you know is likely to be fired next? The student's element. What you'll find then in uses of the SACS API is folks' implementation of state machines, where essentially in a start element method, you might, if you realize, oh, I've just been passed the name of an element, and the name of that element is students. Well, what you'll often do then, if you're using the SACS API at this level, is maybe set a Boolean flag that's called saw students element. Set it to true. Because as soon as this start element method returns, you lose the states of your world unless you've preserved it somehow with like an instance variable or a class variable. So the next time start element is called, the only way you can know conceptually where you are now in the process, parsing of the document, is if you yourself retain state. Because if on the next call of start element, you're passed the name of student, well, the only way you know that this is a child of students is if you yourself have maintained some state. And that's part of what you'll do with the building of a DOM in Project 1, is you'll need to remember where in your structure you are, because if you're building this tree, and literally, as we'll discuss tonight, you're going to be building objects in memory, creating this sort of inverted tree with the root at the top, conceptually. Well, if you want to remember that the next node you part, that the next element you encounter in the document belongs here in the tree, well, you're going to have to maintain some state, specifically a reference to the parent, so that you can attach this guy as a child. But you'll see more of this in Project 1's own code. So why DOM? Well, the SACS API is quick and dirty. It's very easy to use, certainly for simple tasks. But as we said last week, it's this fire and forget API. If you want to maintain any kind of state, you yourself have to implement that. And that very quickly becomes a nuisance, at least for large documents. But it's also a powerful API because it's very low in memory consumption. The fact that you're firing these events and forgetting these events, and the fact that you're not by default maintaining state, means you can fit this in very small devices. So even in these crazy applications of XML's usage on its small embedded hardware, for better or for worse these days, APIs like SACS are typically the most obvious choice because they can run in such small memory spaces. And small memory spaces often means faster speed too, because just allocating memory, managing that memory, and then incurring the cost of paging to disk and so forth can become expensive. So if SACS gets the job done, perhaps it is the right choice. But you need to, it's hard to follow links throughout the data. It's hard to navigate the tree that is an XML document if you yourself are maintaining all of the requisite state. And some of these things, some of these pluses and minuses will become manifest when we actually look at the API or you experience it yourself. But enter the DOM, and we have an alternative view of an XML document. So consider this example. This is just a small XML fragment. Is it well-formed XML? Well, what's well-formedness refer to again? And I may not have never have said it, which means it's an unfair question.
One root element.
One root element.
And
But irrelevant so far as well-formedness goes.
Every element has a closed element.
Every element has a closed element. Every start tag has a corresponding end tag, and they are symmetrically open and closed. Case sensitivity is adhered to. Any attributes have quoted values with single or double quotes. All of these are salient characteristics of what it means to be well-formed XML. So if you say a document is well-formed XML, that essentially means that it adheres to all of those basic building blocks that we started tonight off with. Is everything in accordance with the general grammar? To be well-formed means it adheres to a grammar, and so implicit in that definition is all the things we just rattled off. Because if we weren't consistent with the grammar, those things would be askew. So here's a representative document. It is well-formed. It has one root element. Everything else seems to be in order. It has a comment at the top of the document. So how might you think of this document? Well, it does suggest a hierarchy, right? It kind of suggests a tree. So if you were to draw this thing on paper without looking down at one possible answer, I mean, where would you begin? How might you sketch this thing? Okay. Okay, so I hear the word child, start with students, then beneath that, draw student dangling off of it, so you could leave room for other student elements if need be.
And status is related to Bob.
Okay. Status is related to Bob, which would be a child element of the student element, so we have to, you know, make some room so that things are maybe pretty printed, at least in our minds. And this is captured with this picture here in the way that DOM does in fact capture the same information. Realize that this representative document would first of all be in some text file. So if we're talking about the DOM being a tree, and trees in computer science speak have one root node, if any at all, well, what is the root of an XML document? It's the document itself. Because though we call the first and only element at the top level in the document the root element, what can you have before it or even after it? Document sort of the all-encompassing thing. You can have an XML declaration. What else can you obviously have? PIs, comments in this case. So you have these other XML notions that themselves are not elements and therefore don't contradict the definition of what it means to have one single root element, but they can be before that root element, after that root element. So if we're going to model this thing as a tree, we need sort of a container class at the top that holds everything together at the top level.
You have comment as a child of the document. Can a child define a comment underneath student? Would it be a child of the student element?
Correct. So if we were to, for instance, have beneath here, student. If we had a comment here, and again, PowerPoint is changing our arrows. If we had a comment there, unfortunately my hands are not so quick when it comes to rewriting the trees, where that would appear, they did not provide us with a laser pointer tonight, so where that would appear would be a child of the student element, which means that currently the student element has one child, which we'll get to, or multiple children we'll get to in just a moment. It would become a node here. And there would be another text node because I've hit enter and tab a couple times.
I think you already said this, that if the comments are not guaranteed, you might not have them in the DOM, or are they guaranteed in the DOM?
They would appear in the DOM, but you're receiving application that made use of the DOM, or it depends on the API that you're actually using, if it's built on top of this one, might not necessarily get passed through. So they can be supported. There is a place for them, but they're not always passed through. So just cleaning it up back to its original state, this is the DOM, and it actually might strike you as a little more complicated than you might have sketched on paper, but perhaps only because white space and character content is actually handled even more complicatedly, as this example might seem to suggest. So first, when you model an XML document with DOM, now wait a minute, what does this mean? This means that if you wanted to parse an XML document with a single method call in Java and get back a structure that represents that document, you would get back a reference to a DOM Or more specifically, you would get back a reference to a document object. And so all of the capitalized buzzwords that you see in this picture are consistent with the names that JAXP gives to these several different entities. So there is a class, as we'll soon see, in the Java doc called document, another class called comment, another class called text, and all of these, we'll see, are descendants of a general base class called node, because a DOM, like a tree in general, is made up of nodes. So we'll see some of the class hierarchy in a moment. So what you'll be handed when you call parse, but you call the parse method on a DOM parser, as opposed to a SAX parser, is a reference to a document object. Attached to that document object, as children, in the data structure sense, will be anything at the top level in the document. Could be a PI or none, could be a comment or none, would be at least one child, which is what always? The root element. Not the root of the document, but the root element, just to keep the nomenclature clear. In this case, comment is attached as the first element, and order is important. If the comment appears first, it would appear as the left child of the document, and if the root element appears next, it would appear as the right child. So there is a notion of document order, and we'll come back to this. Comments themselves can't conceptually have children, right, because it's prohibited to nest a comment inside of a comment. So similarly, is that a leaf in your tree, by definition? But elements, here called students, can certainly have children. That is because David made a typo, and David did not catch that one. So I will go back. It's so damn annoying drawing all these boxes, but I will go back and I will add the box. That is a mistake. It should have at least a newline character. Good question, though. Okay? So beneath students, what does it have? Well, it does have, fortunately, this one does have the white space preserved, since I apparently just threw it out previously. So there's a bug in my own parser. But the first child node is a text node. And that is the literal backslash n tab character that induces this indentation of the document. So what is that referring to? Well, it's referring to the fact that I hit enter after typing the close bracket after students and then hit tab, or maybe space space, but in this case we'll assume it's a tab character. A curious thing to note and a nuisance when it comes to parsing XML, we'll come back to that. For now, the next thing that's encountered after that backslash n backslash t is the student element. Now, that student element is the sole child of the student's element, so there are no more children of the student's element except for the text that follows. So there are three children according to this parsing in total. But notice what we've hung off horizontally on this node, which is sort of curious. The attributes. So a DOM is sort of a hybrid, it turns out, of a tree and linked lists, both vertical structures and horizontal structures, if you will, whereby it doesn't make sense similarly, just as with comments, it doesn't make sense for attributes to themselves have children. So it would not be so correct to draw them as children of the nodes. And so what the API does is it strings them off conceptually in a lateral direction using a linked list. So attributes are associated with elements with quite literally a linked list or what's called a node list, which we'll see mentioned in the Java doc, which implementation-wise is probably an array or a vector or a linked list. Doesn't really matter to the programmer unless you're coding at that level in the notion, in the DOM. The value, so this is just for exposition's sake. There are values associated with some of these nodes. We've just tried to keep it simple. So yes, that attribute is called ID, and it does have a value. It's just not shown.
So we need to show another node under the attribute ID.
I'm sorry?
We need to show the value of, for example, ID equals 001. So we need to show another node.
Not a separate node, and this will become clear in the API. This, again, is just for verbal discussion where I've interlaced what it means to be a valued versus a name. A node, as we'll see in the API, every node has both a name and a value, either or both of which could theoretically be null, but by definition, because there is this hierarchy of every one of these entities, whether it's an element or a text node, themselves descend from this Java class called node. Just built into the node class, as we'll see, is a string called name and a string called value. Text nodes do not really have names, but they do have values. So for the sake of discussion, what we've shown here is the value of those nodes. Elements, however, they do have names, but they don't have a hard-coded value because themselves they can have children and so forth. So there's no string value embedded in the node itself. And so for the sake of discussion, the element there is listed with its name. So there is a notion, and we'll get to this, of elements having values. But that's a different concept when it comes to the Java classes. For now, suffice it to say that the value of an element is the concatenation of all of its text descendants in document order. And we'll get to this when we come back to XSLT in the next 2 weeks, but that is simply to say the value of an element, quote unquote, means go recursively beneath that element, find all of the text nodes, concatenate them all together, and that would be the quote unquote value of the element. But that value is not inherently stored in the tree itself. You would have to recurse and figure out what that value is. Which is the distinction. There's a hand going up. Yeah?
The second line of the film. How come that the student is not a text element, which is the new line, and then I'm confused why there's, I think there should be a text element there, which is a new line, then on the third line,
okay,
the text element should only be the tab.
The reason is, so the question is why at this point in the document, is there not a child that includes the new line character? The reason is the moment that you close this angle bracket, you are now inside of an element called student. So anything that follows this angled bracket here that I'm circling with the cursor is now, by definition, a child of that element because it's encapsulated between its start tag and its end tag, which means it belongs beneath it in the DOM. Good question, though.
The DOM API, is it a linear length list or a double length list?
I don't recall offhand. The question is, does the DOM API use a singly linked list, doubly linked list? Underneath the hood, I don't know. The DOM API does not allow you to see it anyway. You interact with what's called a node list, and we'll look at that in just a second. Can you traverse the tree? Yes, absolutely. I'm going to defer that question for just a moment, because then we'll actually answer that by way of looking at what API is actually exposed. So let me come back to that in just a moment. All of this text here is sort of a summary of some of the juicy details that we already talked about for your reference. But just so that we have a segue to actually glancing at the API, notice that DOM essentially makes use of this hierarchy. So I said earlier that we'll see in a moment a class called Node. Descending from that is a whole bunch of other classes, a few of which we saw captured in the tree earlier, a comment node, document, text, attribute, and element. All of these will have associated with them a name and a value, which may or may not be actually present, could be null. But there are some other node types as well, processing instructions and so forth, but here are some of the most basic ones. Let's come back to that, and let's take a look then at what this thing actually looks like. So, JavaDoc is your friend when it comes to this stuff. We want to take a look, for instance, at what it means to be a document. All of this stuff is in the org.w3c.dom package. This is a package that is also in the JDK 142. So if you go to Sun's own documentation, you'll actually see that as a package that ships with Java. We're looking at some Java doc that I generated for ourselves because it's the latest Java doc for JAXP 1.3, which is what you are programming against when you download the latest version of Xerxes. Because recall our discussion earlier, what was it you were installing in that endorse directory? The latest version of Xerxes, which itself implements JAXP 1.3 and some other stuff. So with that said, in this package are a whole bunch of things. Document is perhaps worth looking at. Notice immediately we see confirmation that this class called document extends the node class. So let's actually glance at what it means to be a node. Notice that all known sub-interfaces, so things that, or rather, I kept calling it a class earlier. A node is an interface in the spirit that content handler is. So all of those entities we just discussed, element, text, and so forth, are classes that implement that interface. And notice what does implement this interface, the attr class. Notice the similarity with the attr class you were provided in Project 1, our simplification of it, but similarly named. C data section, character data, comment data, document, some other things, elements, entities, PIs, text, and so forth. What is in a node? Well, here's where we actually, if we want to get really technical and specific, what it means to have a name and a value. And this is not often information you'll need, but just to tie the discussion together, this table in the Java doc tells you for each of the implementations, and I am again telling a bit of a white lie calling those things classes, but we'll come back to that in a moment. With each of these node types, for instance, let's look at text. Each of them has a name and a value. Even if it doesn't necessarily make sense, the name of any text node is just sharp text. It's just hard-coded into the node. Sometimes useful to identify it, but there are other ways to identify it. The value of a text node, that is the string that's stored in the thing called node value, is the same as character data, that data. It's the content of the text node. So it's whatever Joe Bob or sentences or paragraphs are nested in that text node. Looking up at element, well, the element name is as you would expect. It's the name. Same name that you see called in the Sax handler, same name that you saw in our picture of the DOM. The value of an element, though, in the strict sense, is null. To figure out the conceptual value, you do that whole recursive thing, but we'll come back to that with XSLT. Okay? But what can you do with a node? Well, some of these things are useful to bear in mind. Others you may never have occasion to use. But when you're building a DOM, as you may end up doing at some point, append child. It's just the method you call. If you have a node in your hand and you want to append a node to it as a child, just call append child, passing a reference to the node that you want to append. It can be any type of node. That's why these interfaces and the hierarchy is useful. It can be another element, it can be a text node, it can be a processing instruction, comment, whatever. If you want to get all of the children of a current node, and this will be germane to coding you might do, well, what might you call? Okay, you could call get child nodes and get back something called a node list. You could call get first child, get last child. Well, what is a node list if we happen to want to iterate over all of the children, as was suggested before? Well, node list is another interface in JAXP that doesn't let you do all that much. It, by definition, only lets you call get length, which will tell you how many things are in the list, how many children you're holding in your hand, essentially, and you can get the item. So the short answer then is it's not exposed how it is implemented in actual Java code. The JAXP interface only lets you acquire random access to it by way of the item method, but whether it's singly, doubly linked, whether it's a hash table or what, it's hidden from the programmer. So you'll find so often that DOM is also a slow interface for that reason. It typically, when you want to traverse a DOM, even though conceptually it looks like, in our minds, this, where a node might have multiple children, and you might think that you have a direct path from yourself to your ith child. Just follow that edge, as you might in a data structures class, right? Conceptually, just follow that pointer, follow that edge. Well, in DOM, usually these things are implemented not with these direct pointers, but rather with a pointer down to the first child, which is then attached to all the other children laterally, and maybe there's a back pointer with the last child. But there are no pointers directly, usually, from that node to an arbitrary child, which tends to mean that processing a DOM can be slow unless cleverly implemented. And that's why Xerces, something like Xerces, is quite good because it's not implemented with singly and doubly linked lists. It's arrays all over the place with things with memory managed quite intelligently for performance reasons. Let's actually expose what we mean by this being an interface. So it turns out that a text, this thing we've been calling a text node itself is an interface. And so when you actually install or download an XML parser that implements the JAXP interface or that specifically implements the DOM interface, what you're getting in that package are implementations of these interfaces. But the interface itself defines JAXP. It is an API, and that's what you're saying. So with that said, let's do this so that we can lead up to some actual code to highlight. That's sort of a rehash of what we already discussed. Let's do this. Let's start with a very simple sample document. This is one of my rare uses of PowerPoint animation, so try not to spoil it by looking down too much. Here's the sample document. Is it well formed? Okay, sure. It's well formed. All right. It's a pretty simple fragment, but it's going to allow us to highlight exactly how you might build from a sequence of SACS events a DOM. After all, we already said earlier that a common approach to using SACS is to build higher level, perhaps more powerful, more useful APIs on top of it. One of the things you'll do with Project 1 is exactly that. Your DOM builder class will make use of your SACS code to build up a DOM. Well, what's the inherent relationship? Well, let's consider this. Sure. Is there supposed to... Oh, yeah. That's strange. Yeah, no, it's... Oh, I see what happened. There we go. Oh, I hope my animations didn't get messed up. We'll see. Is it all right to have what? No, because you would have had a... It would have been non-well-formed because element names can't have equal signs following them, followed by quote-unquote. No, you must have an element name. It must begin, as we saw last week, with a certain set of characters, essentially alphabetic. Okay, so now hopefully the demo will work better. Hopefully this will not break. All right, so you have a document. When you open an XML document, which is just a file, or you open a stream, which is going to contain XML, what is the first SACS event that's to be fired? Okay, so start document. So the first thing that actually happens as you parse the document, and this is going to be our sequence of events, is start document is called. So this is in the world of SACS. Our goal is to essentially implement conceptually Project 1's DOM builder. So in the world of DOM, what do you probably want to construct when this event is called? That document element, the root of your DOM. In other words, when you're implementing your own content handler or your extension of default handler inside of your start document method, currently it's probably just some boring null implementation if you even touched it at all, right? Because usually with our demo last week, we didn't do anything with start document. It was sort of meaningless conceptually for our, or aesthetically it was meaningless. But now you might implement within this method called start document something that calls new document, open parenthesis, close parenthesis. So conceptually, we'll picture it like that. All right, the next thing to be fired, start elements, because what we've just parsed with our nice little sequence of characters there is start element students, and this was our pseudocode representation of no attributes. What do you need to do on the right-hand side? Add the child. Now, unfortunately, in your world, there is no append child method, since that would make it all too easy. In the actual API, there is. But what you have probably done, hopefully done, in your first parser code is somehow kept around a reference to that document object because you now need to append to it as a child this child. How are you going to append a child? Well, that part of the design is largely up to you. We gave you the class called Atter, or rather, that's completely irrelevant. We gave you the class called Element. But how you string these elements together as children of another element is up to you. You already saw in the API that it uses something called a node list. I suggested last week you use a linked list, doubly linked list, whatever. But that's a design decision up to you. But it does require that you remember where you were in the tree so that hopefully you can drop a reference beneath it. So what's the next event to be fired? Okay, so characters. Right? We haven't gotten too far. So characters are fired. Meanwhile, in the DOM, we probably want to instantiate a new text. We'll be careful here. Not text element, but text node. So that hopefully is installed in the tree because you've retained a reference not only to or not to the document node, but to the child thereof. So that conceptually it's going to be a child of this thing. Next thing to be fired in the document? we keep wanting to say end element, start element. When start element is called, same story as before, we're probably going to want to install in our tree as another child this thing. This time, too, we want to add that attribute, which is code you'll write, but we did give you the atter class. What you fill in there is up to you, and we just capture it pictorially as hanging off of it horizontally. The next thing to be called,
end element.
End element. What do you think we do when end element is called? Okay, so the suggestion from here is don't do anything. There you go. Good, if you take your advice, you're going to find your whole tree, no matter what it looks like, being a long string of nodes. You do need to update your state and somehow get back to the parent node, because the fact that you've called start element means that any next element encountered does not belong here, but belongs there. So you'll have to maintain your state somehow. The next thing to be called is characters for that new line. That's going to end up as a child there, and that would have been a problem. Had we not updated our state, that node erroneously would have ended up here, according to the logic of before. Finally, end element. We're going to update our pointer again. Turns out that's the last element, so end document. Probably an end document. We're going to wrap things up, and that leads us to our 5-minute break. So, candy, restrooms, soda machines downstairs. Resume in 5. So we're back. It sounds like it might be worth pausing for a moment to take a quick look back at Sachs last week, vis-a-vis now this new interface of DOM, just so that it's clear to the sorts of things what you could or might want to do with Sachs and what you might not want to do. So recall last week we looked at sachsdemo.java. When we ran that program on an XML input document, what did that demo do for us? It gave us the Sachs events and that sort of pseudocode we've been using in the PowerPoint slides. So for instance, if this is my document, which I just very quickly whipped up, so it's got two elements and an empty element inside of those, if I ran last week's Sachs demo on that foo.xml document, we got something that was a little ugly, but it was the pseudocode consistent with our discussion in lecture. So suppose that, just for the sake of discussion, because it's a simple enough example, we can whip it up pretty quickly. Suppose that I actually wanted to write a program that capitalized the names of all of my elements. But suppose, for the sake of discussion, there's actually more content in this file. So in fact, instead of Baz being an empty element, we might actually have hello world in here. But we don't want to capitalize anything other than element names. So it doesn't suffice to write a little one-liner, you know, Perl script or just call a Unix function to just say capitalize all of the contents of this file. You actually need to be a little more intelligent. Now, granted, you could do something like a regular expression, maybe Perl, some other language that matches on the angled brackets and distinguishes element names from attribute names and so forth. But let's do it with Sachs because it's illustrative of what you could do with the finely tuned control that Sachs gives you. So here's our document. If we run this original Sachs demo on it again, notice you just get slightly different sequences of characters, but we get the characters out, and we get the start element out, and so forth. And for simplicity, I didn't even put any attributes in it. Well, how did this demo work? Well, recall that the first thing we did, we just checked that we provided a file name at the prompt, boring setup details. The interesting part of the code was just in these 4 or so lines in the try block. In the try block, we had very representative code of how you would use a Sachs parser, not just for this class, not just for this demo, but just in general using JaxP. Line 1, you typically instantiate a Sachs parser factory with precisely that code. Boilerplate code, you can copy and paste at heart's will for now and forever. Line 2, you use that factory to turn out a Sachs parser. The reason for this two-tiered process is so that you yourself don't have to worry about whose parser you're using. You're just using the default implementation of that Sachs parser, whatever's installed in the local system. Line 3, this is just for the demo. We are instantiating one of our own Sachs demo objects because our Sachs demo, recall, itself extended what? Default handler. So now I could have put this main routine elsewhere and just implemented Sachs demo as a content handler or an implementation of a content handler, but we wanted to keep things clean in one single file, so we just in this main routine instantiate one of our own objects, and then we call the parser's parse method, calling the input document's file name and passing into it a reference to this object, the Sachs demo. Well, what's the Sachs demo object? Well, it implements several of the content handler methods itself. one of which is start elements, another of which is characters, another of which is end elements. Notice that I've copied and pasted very carefully, though, the signatures of each of these methods. I looked at the Java doc. I saw, okay, the content handler specifies that the signature must be this, the name of the element must be this, the return type must be this, and it must throw this type of exception, copy-paste job, and then I implemented the behavior I wanted to achieve. So if we wanted to achieve the effect of parsing a document like this with a SAX parser and spitting out an equivalent document except for the fact that its element names are now capitalized, where would I do this? How would I do this? And I'm going to steal the SAX demo code just because we have the framework already set up. What do I want to do? Yep. Oh, let's go here. Q name.
I just want to basically put, I'm assuming there's a method that the call thing could update.
Indeed.
So you would,
in fact, we just looked it up to make sure, uppercase. Yep, and just for one quick note, QName stands for qualified name. This is in contrast with local name, which is another input to this method. We'll come back to this issue when we talk about namespaces. The short of it is that one might be more complicated looking than the other. For now, QName suffices. Okay, so I'm just going to print out to the screen. I'm going to go ahead and print out to the screen QName.toUpperCase.
You're
going to
want to put those brackets in as well.
Ah, okay, good, good. I want to print out one of these. And then I want to print out one of those.
Oh. Aren't you doing the same? The only thing that would be different would be qName.toUpperCase, right? You keep the same code you had, exactly what you had before, and then you have.
No, the goal is to print out XML, not to print out the
code. Right, so I want the actual XML content. I want the essentially the identical file. So I can borrow. So for now, let's close this off. We have the open bracket now, and we have the element name, and just, we'll be a little lazy because we could be really anal and fix a lot of the aesthetic issues of white space and so forth. For now, I'm just going to put a space there because it's going to output an equivalent document, even if we're cheating and adding some white space for speed's sake. This loop now does iterate over all of the attributes. I don't want to do this pseudocode bit anymore, though, so what I'm going to do actually is specify that the attribute's name comes next, followed by, and all these quotes are going to get confusing, followed by an equal sign, followed by, we'll do a single quote just to keep things even simpler, followed by another single quote. And, oh, good, we even have some code here that handles the space. Yeah, so we can do something like that. And in fact, we could even cheat here if we want to be really particular. We can say if at dot get length, whoops, is greater than 0, then what I want to do is system.out.print. All right, so now I've cleaned it up even a little more. Okay. I'm sorry? Right, and even then, we don't necessarily need to do that because hopefully our characters event is going to get fired for all those new lines and tab characters. So, and I'll make one point about whitespace in a moment. Down here now, let's get rid of the pseudocode, now we'll close the tag. So that seems pretty close, if not perfect now. Now, in fairness, what might be getting thrown away in this document? So, yeah. Okay, not quite. Let's go here.
Space in between attributes.
Is that what you were going to say? So, and this is okay because there's nothing in XML spec that guarantees that white space inside of elements will be preserved on each pass through a parser. What we're saying is that if we had space like this, there's no attribute value there, but in our output document, is that going to appear? No. The API doesn't allow you to retain that space because it's just not passed through. It's meaningless. So bear that in mind, but it's probably, if that's important, you're probably using XML for something that's not intended because that inherently has no meaning. So let's go back to our file real quick because we got to clean up. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
But then what I might have, if I understand you correctly, is if I had something like x equals 1, I think what I would get is that then. Oh, before the attribute. Okay, yeah, sure. We could absolutely do that as well. Print out the space before the name of the attribute, and that would guarantee that it would work. Sure. So actually, sure. So let's do that. We'll keep it clean, since that's the kind of code we'd like to promote anyway. So we put the space there. We can now ditch that, and now we don't need that. Even better. Good. I would have taken off a point for myself, too. Good. All right. Characters event, it only has to change insofar as we don't want the pseudocode anymore. But we do want the actual character content coming out. So we're going to just do that. Should get the job done. And the end element is pretty easy, too. We just have to fix this slightly. So what do I want to do in the end element? To upper? Okay. So we have qname dot to upper case, followed by one of those. So there, too, we might be throwing away space, but it's meaningless space, so we're not required to retain it anyway. Start document, you know what? Irrelevant. Let's just let default handler deal with that. End document, it's just we could put it in there and make it null, but that's just kind of silly. And I think that rounds out the methods. There's just three of them. Hopefully we didn't make any typos. No? Sax demo on foo.xml. Here we go. We got something going on in there. What happened? We did capitalize all the names, so that's good. Sorry? It's okay, we seem to have added some stuff. So we have some new lines, maybe? Okay, so this guy actually shouldn't be there. Right, because other characters event is supposed to do this guy too. He's kind of cheating, adding a new line, and this guy too. Oops, Java C. And now, very nice, very nice. Okay, so simple example, but hopefully might make a little more clear why sometimes you might want to whip up a Sax handler just to do some quick and dirty tasks, something in which fire and forget is appropriate and is perhaps the simplest solution. You could do this similarly with something like XSLT, which is an even higher level. You could do it with DOM too, but you'd probably have to end up writing more code than you would with Sax in this case. And the nice thing about Sax is that because it's this event-based approach, you can sort of pick and choose what you implement. And especially by extending default handler, you can just punt to that implementation to deal with anything you don't want to deal with. So it does, in fact, have its uses. And this is not meant to be a compelling use of XML, what we just did, but just representative of how you might use the API relatively quickly at that. So these next several slides pretty much just rehash as a sort of reference a number of the things we already discussed verbally. So I'm going to flip over all of them, except this one here, where we do make more explicit note of this notion of interfaces, just to make the distinction between you're actually using JaxP's interfaces versus someone's implementation of JaxP. Notice that all those nodes and element types and all that that we looked at were, interfaces. So what is Xerces? Well, Xerces is a bunch of classes that implement those interfaces. So for instance, the implementation of the node interface that ships with Xerces is in fact called org.apache.xerces.dom.nodeimpl. But it would be bad practice, programmatically, to ever even mention that thing in your code, because the whole beauty of using a higher level API like JaxP is that those lower level implementation details are hidden from you, because by way of system properties and so forth, all of that detail, the specific implementation, is handled by for you by that whole factory approach. And so it's the factory that, when instantiating a Sax parser, actually implements something in Apache's package space and hands you back a reference to the more general interface that JaxP defines. Questions, comments? And the reason, you might be thinking, well, certainly you're never going to use your parsers that you implement for project one. Most likely after project one, you're probably going to use something off the shelf as Xerxes. Well, what else is there? Well, a lot of software these days actually ships with its own XML parsers. A lot of these GUIs like XML Spy and Stylus Studio, even Microsoft Internet Explorer, all of them have their own parsers built in. Compliant with different versions of the various specifications. So inherent in most of those products is their own implementations. There are other implementations out there. For instance, we will get to XSLT next week, and there is a popular XSLT processor, which I believe ships with its own parser as well, called Saxon, which is written by a guy, which is written by Michael Kay, I believe, who is the author of one of our recommended textbooks. If you've picked up one of those, one of the XSLT books on our list, it's that big red book, I believe, unless I'm confusing the book with a different author, is an author of not only the book, but also this particular parser and XSLT processor. The nice thing about Saxon, particularly being written by quite a clever guy, is that it implements the candidate recommendations of XSLT 2 and XPath 2, whereas Xerxes, for instance, does not. So more so than Apache, he's much more up on the latest drafts of these standards. So worth keeping in mind, you will soon be frustrated or at least aware of limitations or features in various XML-related applications. If you make use of PCs, and specifically XML Spy or Stylus Studio, which we'll introduce next week, you will find that they all too often implement features that are not in the specifications, which means Stylus Studio, for instance, supports ampersand NBSP semicolon out of the box, which means if you develop code in Stylus Studio, you implement web services using Stylus Studio, they might run great on that PC. You port them elsewhere, you're going to start getting XML parse errors. NBSP, what's that? And it's stupid little things like that that, while useful for the programmer, end up causing headaches. Because just like in the browser wars, one browser will support the blink tag, one won't, which means it works on one, doesn't work on the other. And that's why we try to emphasize the actual true implementations, which Xerxes, for instance, is. Documents, elements, attr, other node types. And that leads us to some DOM demos. So what we have in tonight's, among tonight's handouts is not only the lecture slides, but a printout of code. We have two files tonight, document builder demo and DOM builder demo. The latter is excerpted from project one. The former is makes use of Xerxes and the standard JaxP interface. So let's take a look at the standard interface first. We have here all of the requisite includes, which again is often a copy-paste job so you get comfortable with knowing what you need to use. We're going to have a bit of ugly wrap because the font is so big. But what does this demo do? What this demo is going to do is slash prices. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, also inside of tonight's code base is this file. It's not in your print. That is it. Yes, it is. The very last file, last page, items.xml, is just a very simple XML file. Remarkable only insofar, and this is sort of interesting, that not all of the item elements are at the same level. And this is something that can happen. A dangerous assumption to make sometimes when parsing XML documents is that a certain element is only going to appear at a certain level in the document. And if you just blindingly make use of certain XSLT code or certain DOM code, you may end up parsing the wrong parts of the document, especially if the document has not been validated against a schema or DTD that you can trust. So this could cause a little consternation for us, so it's interesting in that regard. What this program, Document Builder Demo, is designed to do is to, using the DOM API, parse this document, create a DOM from it, and then show us what kinds of method calls you can make to manipulate actual data in the DOM and then serialize the result back out to the screen so that we can slash the prices that are inside this file. In short, we want to take an XML input document, we want to output another document whose prices have been discounted. And we're going to do this using the DOM API and highlight some of the relevant features, and it'll give you a taste of what it's like to actually manipulate a DOM in memory. So, in our main routine, we have the boring usage stuff up top, which is just checking the command line for a file name, which is going to be items.xml in this demonstration. And here is the essence of parsing a DOM. The top few lines there, first of all, just define a reference to a document builder, and that's the name given by JAXP to a DOM parser, essentially. Line two, we have try, and what do we try to do? We try to first instantiate a new document builder factory. So this is the DOM equivalent of the SAX parser factory. Beneath that, we actually instantiate a new document builder. Okay? And we catch the appropriate exception that might get thrown. So that's it. What you've just done is set up all the infrastructure for parsing a document by way of DOM. When you're ready to actually parse it, well, we declare a reference to a document. What's a document object? Just to be clear. It's a node. It is that node that's going to be at the top of our tree. So hopefully what the parse routine is going to hand me back is that reference. So what happens exactly? Well, one line of code. This single line of code calls the parser parse routine passing in the file name. What you get back, as promised earlier tonight, is a reference to the DOM that's in memory. This entire routine creates that tree in memory for you. Now, mind you, if it's a huge document, that was probably a dumb decision, because now you've taken up megabytes, gigabytes of memory, and it's all sitting there waiting for you, accessible via this reference. But for some applications, quite appropriate. For reasonably sized documents, certainly. So what do? With that tree? Well, here's the demo. So we instantiate one of ourselves. Document Builder Demo is the file that we're currently in. And then all I do is call this class's slash prices routine on what? Well, I'm going to pass him the current DOM's get document element. Well, this routine, if you look at the Java doc, and the names get so damn confusing with root here and document there, what this returns, guess what, is, well, no, the root element. That routine, for better or for worse, returns the root element of the document, which in this case was items. So that's how you essentially jumpstart the process and get that first root element if you don't care about comments, PIs, and so forth. Well, then what do? Well, for the first time, we're actually showing you how you can now, after having manipulated a DOM in memory, just serialize it back out to standard output. Well, what do we mean serialize? Well, a DOM is like a tree. To serialize that tree means to squish it up into essentially one long string and send that string to the screen or to some file. Fortunately, you do not need to do that. Realize just 5 minutes ago in our SAX demo, the one we just updated, we essentially implemented a serializer. Our SAX event handler essentially took output and then just spit it right back out to standard output. Well, if you have a DOM in memory, you don't, thankfully, have to implement your own SAX handler for that DOM and then print everything back out. You just pass it to this thing called a serializer that ships with, which is in this particular package. It's a helper class that you can make use of. The copy-paste, the output format for now, you can just accept as being correct, something like this. It tells you how you want the output to be formatted. Do you want it to be in UTF-8? And you want it to go to system.out. But for the most part, those three lines of code collectively will just send whatever the root of the tree is, which in this case is doc, to standard output by calling the serialize method. And that's it for the main routine. So the interesting question then is, which of these methods actually does the manipulation of the DOM? Slash prices. So let's take a look. And this, again, is representative insofar as it shows us how to, when handed an element, actually walk the DOM and do some interesting things and actually change the DOM in memory. Well, this method, by default, takes an element reference as its sole argument. What do? Well, we make use of, as we discussed earlier, the node list that are the children of this element. So I just say, get all the children. I get these in a node list. Node list is part of the JAXP interface. Remember, it's incredibly limited in what you can do, but what it does allow us to do, essentially, is iterate over all of the children of this current node. This item call allows us to get the ith child. I don't necessarily know what kind of child it is, though. You might be inclined to have instantiated or declared a reference n to what? Just intuitively. I mean, what is the child of items going to be? It's going to be a it's an item element. But what else could be in an XML document at this level? It could be a PI, it could be text, it could be characters. You want to abstract away and get back the node in this case. Now, here's where we check. This is where you exercise a bit of intelligent checking. If this current node's node type is not this constant, and this is provided in the node interface. This is a all capitalized constant that is a way, is the way of checking what type of node it is. If it's not an element, forget about it. We don't care about anything else in the document. We're just going to leave it alone. But if it is an element, we are going to check that the name of the current node equals quote-unquote price. So getNodeName is going to return the string called nodeName from that node. And this is just, you know, the string classes equals method. If it equals price, we are going to just arbitrarily, for the sake of demonstration, going to declare a primitive called price that is 80% of the value of that price. Now, the 80% is not interesting, but the sequence of function method calls here is. The node n, we're going to get its first child. Well, why is that? Well, what is its first child assumed to be? Well, it's to be this text node, right? So we know that its first and only child is to be this text node. So we're making a bit of a leap of faith here. This code will break on bad inputs, which would be a bad thing because we just dereference potentially a null reference. But it does work on this demo. So get the first child of that node. Get the node's value, because where, again, is a text node's value stored? In its node value. What was in its node name? A little trivia? Yeah, sharp text, which is probably useless. But, and then I'm going to get it as a double value. So this bit is just some Java trickery so that we get a double and convert things nice, because this, after all, is not a double, even though it might look like it. What is it? It's a string, right? XML is string. That's what you're getting back. So this double class has a constructor that takes a string as its argument, which converts it to a double object. And then, using this method, you get the primitive equivalent of that. So annoying Java details for that. But the juicy stuff is in these three lines. The first get first child actually returns the node that is the first child of the current element, which in this case is going to be a text node, whose value is, in the first case, 5.25. Mm-hmm.
And the first child is an item, that name, which is widget, and then the second child is price.
No, because notice, first of all, when we're iterating over all the children, we first check, one, that it's an element, and if it is, we then check that its name equals price. We ignore all the other elements. Okay, so now we've slashed prices. What do we want to do? Well, now, just for the sake of demonstration, what we're going to do is take this current node, we know it's an element because of our type checking earlier, so I can safely cast it to an element because only the element class has a set attribute method implemented for it. There is no set attribute for just a generic node because most nodes, all but one, cannot have attributes. And then this method, as you might infer, takes the name of the attribute you want to set and the value you want to give it. And this df.format is just so that it looks like a nice US dollar amount. And that has added to the DOM, to the current item element, a new attribute called sale price with the value that we've computed. Question for you then is, what does this achieve for us, these last two lines? Right. This else. No, because if we put it as an else here, what that would mean is we're only recursing on elements that are not called price. So, yeah, that would similarly work, and it would make an additional assumption that you don't have item elements inside of price elements, which is probably quite reasonable. Right. Sure. Sure. Could write this in a few different ways, but the point of this recursive call, though it could have been done differently, was to make sure that we do get all items elements, even if they're not at the first level. Yeah. No, we could add some additional checking there. Sure. So that's good. Before you wanted me to take code away. Now you want me to put code in. Other questions about this? Yeah. N is definitely an element at this point because we did this type checking here. And the reason I must cast it is if I go to, and I'll answer this by way of the Java doc, in the JAXP interface, if I go to the node interface, notice that among its methods is not a method called setAttribute, because in the typical case, a node can't have attributes. Only element nodes can have attributes. But what you do see in the elements interface is not only all of the stuff from node in typical Java descent form, but you also get these attribute-related methods. So if you were not to cast it in this line here to an element, the compiler would complain that a node has no method of called setAttribute, and the code would not work. Good question. Other questions? Absolutely. We could have absolutely done this with SAX, and we would have implemented this logic where?
Well, you would have just looked at the element to see if its name was price.
Perfect.
And then you would have once you had an element, then you would have got its attributes.
Right, print out all the original attributes, and then upon in that loop where we printed out all the attributes in our newer SAX demo, you would check, does the current attribute's qname equal, quote unquote, price? And if so, do the multiplication and print out a new attribute.
But here, you actually added a new attribute.
Correct.
And in SAX, did you do
that? SAX.
You could have changed the price to a sale price.
Correct. And we could have added a new one just by calling system.out.print if we're just printing as a standard output, which our SAX demo is. Right, you don't create anything with these SAX handlers, at least the way we've used them. You would just print some additional content out. Right, you would print out new what's it called? Sale price equals, quote unquote, 80% times whatever the value is. So absolutely, we could do that. I just thought we'd be beating a dead horse to do it both ways. But what has happened now? By the time all of this recursion finishes, this method slash prices ultimately returns. That method has been destructive. It has actually modified the DOM. And on those element nodes, whose name is item, it has added to whatever linked list is actually implementing the attributes, a new attribute called sale price. And as just to link this to the problem set, to the project, the object that is attached laterally to an element in our DOM is called What is it called? It is not exposed. You only interface with the attributes by way of the get attribute, set attribute, and so forth, which is why when we... Actually, is that a lie? Let me double check, since I'm confusing the project with the actual API myself. Correct. The JAXP interface, like your project, will not expose however it is the attributes are being associated with the object. Right? You can't just say, give me the hash table that is the attribute set for this node. You can't say, give me the linked list, give me the array. But what you can say is, give me the attribute and its value. Specifically, you could call get attribute and specify the name of the attribute. Attributes' names, recall from lecture one, must be unique. Can't have two identically named attributes for a given element, which means this call is like a database key lookup. Give me the attribute and its value for this particular attribute name. In this case, you get back the value. If you call this getAttributeNode, you get an attr object. Whether that attr object is currently stored in a linked list or hash table is unclear to you, the developer. And this is why in project one, last week I suggested that you use only the attr object for your DOM code. You use the attributes objects, the class, for the SAX code. Because where is attributes, capital A, used? It's used in SAX. when you pass around in start element the attribute list. It's used in SACS. But you should not be exposing most likely that attributes class or objects to anyone using DOM because it simply doesn't exist in the interface. And so with that said, DOM builder demo.java is a little bit of demo code that makes use of Project 1's DOM builder. Project 1's DOM builder is what we waved our hands at in section last week, but is the place where you will implement your DOM building code. So whereas JaxP calls it document builder, we call it here DOM builder. It's a simplified form of the same. This little demonstration does the following, and this will be a useful demo that you can use once your own code is working. So notice that the main routine here, again, grabs the file name, bit of a leap of faith there, that it's actually present. Notice that this is not JaxP code. This will only work, this code, when you have implemented your own first parser correctly. This line instantiates one of your own my first parser objects. Why is it that? Well, notice we've imported project1.mf, which is the package in which all that stuff is. And then I instantiate a DOM builder. With my parse routine, I call parse on the XML parser, passing in a reference to DOM builder. Well, the DOM builder is that class that you'll be implementing for project one. Then what I do here for our demonstration is once the DOM has been built by your DOM builder code, now I can use it. I call your DOM's getDocument routine, which hopefully has been implemented to return doc, and I think the code out of the box might already do that for you. I'm then going to instantiate one of my little demo objects like we've been doing tonight, and then I'm going to try to visit that DOM's root element. Well, what does that mean? Notice, just like with our previous example, your DOM builder class will have a getDocumentElement method, which returns the root element. What does this visit routine do? Well, apparently, it recursively counts elements and text nodes. So it counts the total number of element and text nodes in the document. Hopefully this is consistent with what you think. So what I'm going to do, just to demonstrate, we'll use items.xml. And what I'm going to do is set my class path to equal the code that we implemented. That's a command you cannot yet type. But if I now run DOM builder demo.java and run it on items.xml. And the reason this works is because what I just added to my class path was the staff's solution code that does, in fact, have all that stuff implemented. We have 12 elements and 23 text nodes. If we look at this thing, we don't need to count up 23 things, but are there 12 elements? Hopefully. And there are. So suggestive that my code works, but not necessarily an exhaustive test. But it is code that you can actually use. And the reason for demonstrating it here is just how you would interface not just with JaxP, but the similarities with the actual JaxP interface of Project 1's code. But how does this actually work? Well, not hard to see. All the visit method does is it first checks with a switch what the current node type is of the node being visited. If it's a text node, we increment this global counter, text nodes plus, text plus plus. If it's an element node, we similarly increment it. But if it's an element, what can an element have? Children, which means we need to get all of its children. We're going to declare an iterator. So this is another way of actually getting the children, because in this case, getChildNodes is defined to return a list of some sort. So we can iterate over it with the iterator, and we just need to recursively call visit on that child element as well so that we get elements at all levels in the tree. Questions? Yeah?
Is it only documents and elements that have children?
Is it only document nodes and element nodes that have children? Correct. Correct. And the, yes? Okay. So tying this all together, we did see something tonight briefly that came up in last week's lecture too. This whole name, the whole issue of qname and local name. This again is an issue of namespaces, and we'll come back to this in a few weeks' time when we actually look at namespaces themselves, which a namespace essentially is possible in XML by prefixing an element's name with another string and colon. So namespaces similar in spirit to what you can do with C, C++. You can do this in effect with Java with packages. Same kind of feature. We'll come back to that. DOM Builder demo we just took a look at. And what we will do next week is look at CSS briefly, because it was originally considered a possible language via which to manipulate XML content. But as we'll see, it's all too limited for doing so. XPath, which is fun insofar as it will actually let you, with very intuitive queries, access arbitrary content in your XML document and not necessarily have to think recursively. If you want to dive into the document and get the fifth price element, well, you just write a little expression, a one-line string, that does precisely that, with a nice forward slashes and predicates and so forth. It's a powerful language. We'll look at XSLT, which, recall, is the language that we'll use predominantly in Project 2 for manipulating Xtube, My Blockbuster, and so forth. Trax, which is a subset of JaxP. It's the transformation API for XML. And bear in mind, if you've had a little too much Java already with Project 1, Project 2 is completely independent of Java. It will be client-side code still, but mostly written in XSLT and other such things. And then in Projects 3 and 4, we'll segue to server-side goings-on and focus on J2EE with XML. So with that said, I will stick around for a bit here, and then at 5 after, we'll start section, which will be informal Q&A in room 106. See you next week.